might slip, you might slide, you might stumble and fall by the roadside. But don't you ever let nobody drag your spirit down. Remember you're walking up to heaven. Don't let nobody turn you around. Walk with the rich, walk with the poor. Learn from everyone, that's what life is for. And don't you let nobody drag your spirit down. Remember you're walking up to heaven. Don't let nobody turn you around.
That's singer, songwriter, and acoustic blues musician Eric Bibb with Don't Let Nobody Drag Your Spirit Down. It's from his 2001 album, Painting Signs. Eric Bibb is the son of the late musical theater and folk singer and actor Leon Bibb. He was born in New York, but moved to Europe in 1970. He lives in Helsinki, Finland. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we're going to be talking a little bit in the first half of the program about what you think is unfolding. What do you make of the political scenarios that we're confronted with every day? And what did you think of the series that we did on the Clinton Foundation? Did you learn anything new? Did you learn anything about the political landscape? Did it affect your thinking, your disposition? We can certainly begin to talk about that. In the second half of the program, however, we are going to Detroit. And the reason for Detroit, and we have to always remember, Detroit is a template for what will be happening all across the country, especially in what are politely referred to as, quote, urban areas, unquote. These cities are being systematically emptied. They're being, as the phrase is, reimagined, as Detroit has been and continues to be. Detroit is in its third year. Its third year of drastic changes that people have to deal with that are so onerous. It is horrible what they have to deal with every day. But that is the direct result of the forced bankruptcy that was imposed upon the city of Detroit, ostensibly to meet an $18 to $20 billion debt. But of course, as we have been detailing on this program, it was not necessary for Detroit to declare bankruptcy. It was a forced bankruptcy, and it was part of a larger plan to literally empty the city of what is seen as an undesirable population, attract a, quote, new and desirable population, and begin the process all over again. And we will be taking a look at Detroit's schools and how these battles over community control of schools, over education, over the resources of the city, over simple things like that you take for granted, like water and electricity and so forth, how these things are being carefully managed. And it is a template that is being developed for other cities as well, where the municipal authorities will be engaging in a systematic attack on these predominantly Black and Latino cities and changing things around. So we could expect this to be a case study, and that is why we have to constantly keep our fingers on the pulse of Detroit. So Abayomi Zikiwe will be joining us in the second half of the program. He'll be giving us an update of what's life like in the city of Detroit now in its third year of having to service this imposed debt through bankruptcy and the permission of the courts essentially to sell off the assets of the city, to sell off the city services, to curtail the city services, to make life so hard in order to pay off this so-called debt. But that's where we're going. But for the first part of the program, let's talk a little bit and find out what your attitudes are based on the last couple of programs that we've done, exposing the shenanigans associated with the Clinton Foundation and its several related entities. What I want you to appreciate is that you are ahead, way ahead of the entire country on this question, because, and this is typical, I don't want to sound boastful or anything, but this is what we do. Remember, we are looking at a situation from a position of clarity, and we have the best information available to you. So now the news organizations are catching on. They're now just catching on. You've been ahead of this through the careful tutelage of Charles Ortel. I urge you to go to his website, Charles Ortel, ORTEL.com. You'll see the documents related to all the things that we've discussed and more. But this is a major scandal. And he has exposed, once again, corruption at a level that we could hardly imagine. We could hardly imagine that it would occur at that level. And involving a former president of the United States and a person who wishes to be president of the United States. But this is the reality, and you got to be familiar with it. 888-874-4888. We have half an hour to chat. Let's talk about what your feelings are based on the stories in play, especially about the Clinton Foundation and its related enterprises. How is it? I mean, here's Hillary Clinton saying, well, you know, if I'm elected president, in other words, if you elect me, here's the deal I want to strike with you now. If you elect me, I'll shut down the Clinton Foundation. It's like, it gives you an idea about the mindset. It is not about whether, if you're elected, you will shut down the Clinton Foundation. The issue is you must shut down, the Clinton Foundation must be shut down, and criminal charges must be pursued here. There's something horrendously wrong with how this entity has been operating, the lawlessness of it, and the contrast is that ordinary citizens are held to such a high standard. And they pay a huge price when they supposedly break the law. Here are two people in your face, in the nation's face, for years, for decades, actually, have been breaking the law with impunity. And even now, as the evidence mounts, Hillary Clinton is taking the position, well, I'm still in a position to bargain. I can still wiggle out of this, but you have to elect me president first. And then I'll figure out whether I should shut down the Clinton Foundation. I mean, the arrogance is beyond belief in this political couple. The arrogance is just beyond belief. But it is good that we are seeing how widespread this attitude is. And it is encompassing aspects of the so-called progressive community, too. I mean, we have people in the entertainment world and people, you know, big money people who are playing the same game. So, I mean, what does this say about our so-called standards? What does it say? Eva from San Diego, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I was watching the new morning reports on Sundays with Stefano, what's his name, on ABC.
Stephanopoulos.
And Hillary Clinton's new campaign manager came and claimed that the foundation has saved millions and millions of lives in Africa with those medications, medications they've been sending. And I was shocked to hear that because we know darn well that it's not true. But he wasn't challenged at all by Stefano, and he portrayed the foundation as it was the saver of millions of lives. And I like your comments on that and how we can challenge such lies.
Well, keep in mind that George Stephanopoulos was, in fact, working within the Clinton administration at one point. He donated. He had to admit at one point that he donated, I think, about $75,000 to the Clinton campaign. And the organization, the news organization that he's working for, they pretty much are in the pocket of the Clintons. They are not interested in bashing this or exposing any wrongdoing because they believe that they are going to be part of history, and they're looking forward to the millions and millions of dollars that will be spent right at this time. The media organizations, I said earlier on, this campaign will have about five or maybe even more, $5 billion in advertising money. And that's a lot of money for the media organizations to have. So they've all been playing ball to get a portion of it. So we've seen the sympathetic coverage. We've seen the very positive coverage. We're going to see even more of it because now, as we head toward the general election, this is when they unleash their advertising budgets and they're spending money like crazy. Clinton, I was made to understand, she had about $80 million in advertising scheduled for media. So there's a big fight going on right now as to who will get the money. And in order to get the money, they have to play ball. And this is what they've been doing. Everybody's talking about the good that the foundation has done and whatnot. And not one of these organizations, not one of them, has been able to report that they actually subjected to very tight scrutiny the reports of these foundations and have determined, which is so easy to do, that the foundation itself is operating illegally. It wasn't chartered to do any of this work. It is actually in violation of the law. And as Charles Ortel had told us, the pharmaceutical companies that the Clinton Foundation partnered with in these medical pharmaceutical endeavors themselves were under grave suspicion. And in fact, one of them had to pay a fine of $500 million for producing substandard phony medications. So we have, a nest of vipers here, and the media have to take responsibility for protecting this because they're not doing good journalism at all. It should be clear to them, and these are basic questions. Is the Clinton Foundation chartered, legally permitted to engage in any of the things that they've been engaging in all these years? What authority, under what section of law are they constituted to do these things? These are some basic questions that the journalistic community as a whole needs to start asking. And, you know, like somebody says, oh, well, she filed her taxes. As a journalist, you know, you want to know, did they file the taxes for all of the Clinton Foundation endeavors? Are those filed as well? Are those available to the public for inspection right now? No. Did you see on Hillary Clinton's tax forms any reference to income deriving from the Clinton Foundation listed? No. But they're busy telling the world that she filed her taxes. Adopting the prescripted line and the prescripted narrative of the Clinton Foundation. We are at a point, it is not just the scuzziness of politics, it's the scuzziness of the media. And I have to say that the people who are doing good journalistic work, this is it's a conservative media. They're doing journalism. They're looking for the answers. And they are not letting this thing go. Thanks, Eva, for your call. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Trace, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. The work by Charles Otero and the investigation of the Clinton Foundation is a very, very informative piece of work that he's done.
Oh, it's not finished. There's more, lots more coming. And well, I tell you, it's going to be a very tough, tough climb for Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton once these new things come to light.
Well, I mean, just what he's presented alone should basically, you know, if somebody looks at it very closely and intelligently, that alone should steer you away from Hillary Clinton. But unfortunately, and, you know, just talking to people, you know, about, you know, their political consciousness, and I tell them about, you know, Charles Ortel and the work that he's doing, you know, exposing the Clinton Foundation, it seems like it's still not enough to change people's minds about supporting Hillary Clinton, especially, you know, I hate to say in the black community. You know, I tell them, you know, about the Clinton Foundation, and they just don't seem to, you know, they just don't seem like it's a problem, because one of the things about the Clinton Foundation that they're doing, fraud and theft, I mean, to me, it's the American way, you know. Fraud and theft, you know, is the American way, and people seem to be okay with it unless you're stealing from the rich. And to me, the only way Clinton is going to not get support from the black community if she talks like Donald Trump, who talks like a white supremacist. But it's so funny because Donald Trump talks like a white supremacist, but Hillary Clinton is doing the work of a white supremacist. So it's like, so because the thing is that when you talk about, you know, racism and white supremacy, you know, we kind of look at this thing emotionally instead of intellectually. And if you were to look at it intellectually, you would see that Hillary Clinton is probably more dangerous than Donald Trump. So, and then you look at the other side of the spectrum, what I just said a few minutes ago, rich people aren't going to, you know, go against Clinton because of the fact that she's not stealing from them. She's stealing from people who really need, you know, who really need the money, who is supposed to be, quote unquote, the charity is supposed to be helping. So, we're not looking at this carefully. We're not looking at this intellectually. And I'm just feeling that Mr. Ortel and other media people can bring out more, and it's just not going to change the minds of people. This is sad state of affairs for the political consciousness of the entire American people.
Well, I see what you're saying, and I agree to a large degree, because, you know, in this political race, a lot of it hinges on psychology. How do people think, and how can we persuade them to think a particular way, irrespective of the facts? All right, the facts are staring you in the face, and like you said, people are still, well, I'm for Hillary anyway. Mm-hmm. that tells you that the campaign has capitalized on this aspect of the psychological conditioning. And the psychological conditioning has to do with the affinity of people of color, particularly to the Democratic Party. And the psychology at another level says, if you are to be shown evidence that would cause you to change your mind, you also might be indicting yourself for being so silly to believe them in the first place. So the denial comes in by saying, well, I'm for Hillary because I made that choice. I'm not interested in admitting to myself that I made a bad choice or I could be wrong about this choice. So I'm sticking to my guns in order to satisfy my psychological need to be okay with the decisions I've made. You know, it's like buying a car. You know, you go in and you buy a car and you know, as you sit there signing the papers, as you are writing the check, you know you're not happy with this choice at all. And you probably are making the worst choice in your life up to that point. But you proceed because it is worse to you in your own head to admit your own deficiency, that you're wrong. So you stick with it because that is itself a kind of comfort that, you know, you're sticking to your course. Does that make sense to you?
I'm getting the thing.
You know what I mean? So a lot of people are for Hillary. They can't tell you why. If you were to ask them to pinpoint chapter and verse as to why she is the choice, they can't do it because they're operating at a purely psychological level. They've been told in so many words that she is the preferable candidate. And they've been told by leaders, quote unquote, by popular opinion. They see the sympathetic coverage on the media. So they're at peace with this decision, even in the face of evidence, even in the face of reports that point to the contrary. They will stick with their decision because it's a psychological need to feel at peace with what you are thinking and doing.
And I totally understand because, you know, like even with me, you know, I love Pop-Tarts. But when I look at some of the stuff that's in Pop-Tarts, it doesn't really, because Pop-Tarts taste so good, even though it's bad for me.
Right. It's funny because you say that one of my grandnephews, as a matter of fact, I sat with both of them, actually, and one morning at the breakfast table, and I said, listen, we are going to read the ingredients in this thing that you call breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And they were appalled. they haven't said, this is what you are doing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's no more Pop-Tarts at any time of day. So the idea is that we have a need. And this is part of the calculating of political campaigns and advertising campaigns and just general media. A psychological need to feel at peace with the decision that you're making. And the decision that you're making is in turn conditioned by the decision, by the information they provide. So it's all wrapped up in one. Mm-hmm. And it's a very hard thing for people to tear themselves away from what they want to do and look at the possibility of something that they have to do, which they would consider unpleasant and contrary to what they set out to do in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So you will write the check and you will roll out of the car lot with a car that you don't like. You don't like the car, but you can't tell anybody that.
Mm-hmm.
You now have to put on a great face and tell people, hey, how you like my new car? Knowing you really are not at ease with this decision. But you don't want to be looking like an idiot. So you suck it up privately and you say, okay, hey, you learn, you force yourself to live with a decision that really you would rather not have made.
Yep.
But I'm glad that you're getting some good information out of the Charles Ortel series that we've been doing. It's a lot more to come. And I've been talking also with people from overseas whose governments are also looking into the Clinton Foundation. And what they're discovering is just frightening. And we will be talking about that here as well. Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you.
Hi, thank you.
From Queens, Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Therese. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I want to thank you. Good afternoon. I want to thank you for the Charles Ortel, our week-long series and investigative report. It's excellent. I've been following along with his website as well as some other, more or less, I would say some of it coming from the conservative camp, which would lead some people, and I would say, given the nature of politics and the way the Republicans have played their card, to question the investigative work, not of Ortel, but of others that report on the Clinton Foundation as the facts come out. So it's campaign as usual. I mean, the Republicans have a fairly specious type of lineup of campaign, you know, from Ailes to, I don't know, Rose not involved yet, but, you know, all their light Breitbart and type of agents that they have would lead one to be skeptical about the information coming out. But that's where, I guess, the discerning audience and discerning citizen would need to do a more work. I mean, you can't just come home, turn on the TV, and have the typical political polemics play out, and that's the framing in which you're operating from. So what I am getting at and would like to be more concise about is that, you know, I would think just like everyone's parading, well, let's see, not everyone, but the hope is that the black vote will go towards Clinton. I think much of what has happened is the Democratic Party's lock on the U.S. minority vote, black vote in particular, because inherently self-interest, unfortunate a perception of self-interest, that is very narrow-minded. It's almost parochial in that it only looks at what's in it for me as a American in America and not looking at the broader implications, because you'd have to indict the entire system and look at it from that point of view as to how America's wealth, Europe's wealth, Western wealth has come about, exploiting the less fortunate and other nations throughout the world, or other peoples throughout the world. And until we, I think, look at have a critical analysis of that, we blindside ourselves. So, well, I favor having the first black president. No, you favor having the first black imperialist president, or the first female president, the first female imperialist presidency. And I want to stop right now, but I'd like to hear your comment on it. But that is where I think we're blindsided, and that we won't really absorb this thing for what it is.
I think you are very much on point here with that observation, because this election year, for some reason, I call it it's a game changer. If we utilize it as such, as a great point of departure from what this is, which is the norm. We are finally being confronted with what the norm is, and it's ugly, it's bad, it's undesirable. And we should want to learn from this period how best to move ahead, but operating differently on a different plane. And we've gotten all this instruction from all these different sectors, from the Bernie experience to the Clintons out and out, super marauders. We have Donald Trump as the bull in a china shop, scaring the staid Republican Party. We have the question of what is a party supposed to do anyway? We're getting to that tomorrow, by the way. What can we discern and distill from this moment to broaden our understanding of this thing called politics, and more so how we are to utilize this process for the goals that we say we share. We want progress. We want peace. We want everyone to have
some of
their,
us do.
You know, but
I think some of us do, and I think that's the placards that get held up during the national election, that we're good and exceptional type of people. And I believe that we as Americans, and I am an American, want to believe the best in it. But that's the framing of our desires. But our actions speak differently. Here we are with a disastrous, you know, nothing new, but outright, out in your face, clear demagogue and possible fascist, and a party system that brought about this Frankenstein. And then you have another hand here, your traditional established demagogue of Democrats and their agenda for a new America, all of them forward in furthering the interests of the PNAC. And essentially, we have to, really examine this, and hopefully average Americans begin to look, what am I voting for? And do I really believe what I say I believe in, the Constitution, freedom of people, the desire to do goodwill in the world? Or I'm simply just blindsided, who's going to give me the next job? Who's going to make sure I have food? Yes, those are important things, but we compromise on morality for the sake of it. And unfortunately, the ultimate decider is going to be the climate. It's going to be this devastating situation that will level the playing field. And there will be no more debate because civilization won't exist. And that's a frightening prospect, but it's real. Because we have refused to face our challenges as individuals, as communities, and how we identify ourselves.
Well, you gave us a lot to think about, and it is all important. We really should use this time to think about these things on a whole different level and to see where the contradictions are. And more so, how is it that we are going to move beyond this point, but move intelligently beyond this point? Thanks, Jay, for calling. We're now joined by Abayomi Azikiwe, editor-in-chief of Pan-African Newswire and a Detroit organizer for the Workers' World Party. And we're going to talk about what is life continuing to be like in Detroit under these exacting conditions of trying to satisfy a forced upon multi-billion dollar debt. Hi, Abayomi. Good to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, what's going on in Detroit? What's the life like? How are people coping? What's the rate of foreclosures? And what do you observe? You're there every day. You're in the community. What's your sense of the pulse of Detroit today?
There's a lot of anger, and there's a lot of discontent among the majority of the people that live in the city. You have a official narrative that says Detroit is coming back, that it's a post-bankruptcy, post-emergency management situation, and people are interested in investing in the city. Nonetheless, the so-called investments are very limited, and they are confined to these same prestige projects, repurposing of buildings, the opening of restaurants and entertainment district businesses. There's going to be a new hockey arena that's owned by Mike Ilitch, the pizza magnate who owns Little Caesars Pizza. And there's a few housing units that are being built just north of downtown. But largely beyond that, there's still massive property tax foreclosures and also water shutoffs. And even the Detroit News had an article that was published today entitled Detroit Water Shutoffs, the Live Business Priority. And they have priority in quotation marks, saying that despite the rhetoric from the Mike Dugan mayoral administration that the bulk of the shutoffs are still being focused on residential customers, and that the homes account for a little more than half of the $119 million in delinquent bills, but nearly all of the shutoffs. And since April, these crews have gone out and they've shut off service to 13,750 residences in the city, but only 369 businesses And this is according to city records that were acquired through the Freedom of Information Act. So we can still see the targeting of the working people and the poor for these draconian measures. But yet the large-scale businesses and economic interests are getting tax breaks, and they're being allowed to use as much water as they want, and they don't have to worry about being shut off. So that gives you an indication of what is actually happening in the city.
Is there any fight left in the city, or has the plan succeeded so well as to vanquish opposition?
Well, there's people who are disillusioned, and people who have been forced out of the city to the suburbs and to other parts of the state. But then there's still a core of people, and they're very, very consistent, very militant, working on educational issues, the water issues, property tax issues, issues involving police brutality and murder, which is still a problem in the city of Detroit, who are still organizing on a regular basis. So a lot of people are still very much concerned about what's happening. And not just the Moratorium Now Coalition and other organizations as well. In fact, one group of people, they have embarked upon a research project mapping the water crisis in Detroit, where they have gotten some academics to do research on how the water crisis actually impacts the city. And the Metro Times had published an article also recently, as well as Michigan Radio, talking about the link between the Detroit water shutoffs and tax foreclosures. That there's a definite link between the two, and this is going to be a focus of the Mapping the Water Crisis, which is the new research collective project that's going on right now. So it's good to have this information, but at the same time, people are still organizing around it. There's other controversies. For example, this business called U.S. Ecology is in the process of implementing a contract to pour fracking waste from Pennsylvania into the Detroit water and sewage system. The sewage system saying that it can stand more pollution. And it's not clear what the long-term impact of that is going to be, and there's a coalition formed around that as well to oppose what U.S. Ecology is doing. Therefore, all of these different organizations and coalitions are continuing to work. There's a lawsuit, several lawsuits involving the school system. There's still at least three major lawsuits involving the emergency management and bankruptcy that are still in the federal courts. The retirees, they're in the federal appeals court right now. They're waiting for a decision after filing their objections to the pension cuts and the health care cuts. And there's also the overall constitutional issues involving the imposition of Public Act 436, which was the emergency manager law, the so-called dictator law. And these cases are ongoing. Therefore, this is not a situation where the people in Detroit are remaining stagnant or becoming disillusioned. Many of them are still pushing forward.
You've been covering for Lead Stories. We've been talking about Detroit and specifically the bankruptcy. You've been updating us about the fallout from that bankruptcy proceeding, where the assets pretty much have been sold off to the highest bidder and the well-connected, the monumental numbers of people who have had their water shut off, their homes foreclosed. We've talked about the high rate of unemployment, the devastation, essentially, that this once thriving city, this once bustling city, would never have been associated with. Is there any doubt in your mind, or is it an exaggeration to say that Detroit is, in fact, a template for what's to come in other cities very soon?
Most definitely. It's already happening. If we look at what's going on in Chicago with the school system there that has been starved of resources by the state, we can see that for African Americans, the state of Illinois has the highest unemployment rate in the whole United States. They also have an extremely high, if not the highest, homicide rate, shooting rate in Chicago. Some weekends, there's up to 40 to 50 different shootings in one weekend. And then, of course, the police are raining down terror on a daily basis against the African-American and Latino community in Chicago. Baltimore, we saw what happened last year with the rebellion, and they're faced with similar water crises. Detroit, and the same thing exists as well in Pittsburgh. So, yes, this is a national problem that's taking place. I visit New York fairly regularly, and I can see there that many areas of the city, the African-American and working-class population, poor populations, have been driven out completely. And the homeless situation in New York is, according to the statistics, is worse than it's ever been, which is almost unbelievable, even worse than it was in the 80s and the early 90s. They say they have tens of thousands of people living in shelters in very, very unwholesome conditions in New York City. And there's so many people on the street now, even in Manhattan, Midtown and Lower Manhattan, you see so many homeless people on the streets. This is a phenomenon across the United States. And what's interesting about this is that this is an election year. And this is what you were touching on in your last segment. Like, where is the debate around the urban crisis in the United States in this election? I mean, why isn't the Democratic Party, and this is a rhetorical question, but why isn't Hillary Clinton talking about the disparate conditions in education, in environmental justice, the utility shutoffs, the property tax foreclosures, the wholesale removal and so-called gentrification of urban areas throughout the United States at the expense of African Americans, Latinos, the poor, working class people? These issues are not even being raised. The only thing we hear about is questions of trust and whether or not somebody is sick, or, you know, whether or not the Clinton Foundation was a pay-for-play operation, now, which it, in all likelihood it was. But where's the real focus on the issues? The Flint water crisis. Hillary Clinton was in Flint during the primaries. She did commercials from Flint. She wanted to make the African-American people, not only in Michigan but around the country, feel as if she was so concerned about this majority black city, post-industrial city, that has been devastated as a result of the closure of the auto plants. And yet she lost the elections in Michigan. And since then, I have not heard her raise even once the Flint water crisis. And mind you, nothing has really been done to rebuild the infrastructure in Flint. There is about 9 people who have been indicted, but they are mainly lower-level bureaucrats who have been indicted by the state attorney general. So why aren't these issues being discussed by the Democratic presidential candidate and other candidates for the Democratic Party? There seems to be a desire not to address these issues.
But I will ask the question also of the left.
Yes.
Why aren't these issues being discussed on the left? Why are they going along with the establishment and discussing things on their terms? Why aren't we saying, look, what is happening right now is worthy of deeper consideration and analysis so that we can implement entirely different policies to correct these things and a political structure that would accommodate these things? Isn't this the kind of work that they should be doing now?
I agree 100% that they are not you know, the so-called left in the United States is not putting forward its own programmatic and political and ideological alternative to the status quo. And when I say the status quo, I mean the propaganda that's been advocated by the Republican Party, which is all over the place in terms of Donald Trump, but also the Democratic Party, which is evading the major issues of the day. Now, I have not looked thoroughly at the Green Party program. They had done a program recently, broadcast recently on CNN. But hopefully, through Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka, they can address some of these issues. It seems like it's a good opportunity for alternative political parties this year to increase their base of support. I see the Libertarian Party, which its candidate was alienated from the mainstream, or at least what appears to be the mainstream of the Republican Party. And then, of course, the selection by Jill Stein of Ajamu Baraka for a vice presidential candidate. You would think that there would be an uptick in support for, you know, those disaffected from the right, as well as those disaffected from the left. But they, too, have to come up with a solid program to address these issues, because nobody else is going to do that.
Well, I'm going to draw on your expertise as a political scientist. When do you think, what is the closest parallel that you could recall to the conditions in Detroit? At what other time do you recall that Detroit was in a similar situation, and what got it out of that situation?
Well, we can look back to the era of the Great Depression in the last century, where there was massive unemployment and homelessness and hunger in the city, and people were able to organize. The left in particular was able to organize under the banner of the Communist Party and other organizations in the early 1930s around anti-foreclosure programs, the demand for jobs and relief, and also for food, because they had hunger marches here in the early 1930s, and those marches were attacked by the police. People lost their lives. And then, of course, there was a huge upsurge in the labor movement during the early and mid-1930s. In this period, it's different from the standpoint that we've had a total shift in the economic structure of the United States. A lot of the manufacturing capacity has been relocated in areas of the South where they're not, the unions are not that strong or well organized. Also, overseas. And you have a burgeoning service economy here in this country. Now, within that framework, you have the campaign for $15 an hour and unionization of low wage workers, which is a positive development. But it still needs to have a political character as well. The $15 an hour movement under the leadership of the SEIU had a big convention in Richmond a couple of weeks ago, which attracted 10,000 people demanding a general raise in the minimum wage in the United States. But how is that going to happen? So far, it's been happening as a result of pressure from below, and then the passage of legislation on a municipal and state level. We've seen very little on a federal level in regard to the raising of the minimum wage. And even though Hillary Clinton may say or give some lip service that the minimum wage should be raised, I don't think she's come out clearly in support of a $15 an hour minimum wage and a union for low-wage service employees and non-service employees, because you have people working in industrial settings that are making far less than $10, $15 an hour, some making as less as $10 an hour. which is outrageous. But that is happening even in the Detroit metropolitan area. But yes, the left has to come out with a extensive, detailed, programmatic plan that addresses the majority of the people in this country who are combined black, brown, people from the Middle East, women, the LGBTQ community, people living with disabilities. This is the majority now inside the United States, even though you may not know that by watching the corporate media news. But that is the reality of the situation. And so far, those people have still remained captive of the Democratic Party. That is the tragedy, and that is the challenge of what we're facing right now. Where can they go in November? They can stay at home. They can vote for the Green Party. They can vote for Workers' World Party. There are other political parties that are on ballots and have write-in status in various states. But it's going to take a lot beyond November to effectively address these issues.
But it seems to me that Detroit is the perfect place to start because it poses all these problems that typically will pop up in especially urban areas and have been plaguing urban areas now for decades. But the unions and the smaller parties, they're getting wrapped up in all the, you know, they're reacting to things as they arise. But I'm wondering about whether you see that also as a deficit, that the lack of an articulation of a long view, a comprehensive long view that should inform the third party effort.
I agree. That is a serious deficit. And the reluctance could very much be related to the lack of organizational capacity to really effectively address these issues. For example, the question of joblessness in the cities. What do you do about it? How do you mobilize and organize thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of youth to demand jobs, to demand economic opportunities? How do you organize hundreds of thousands of people to stop gentrification, which is plaguing most of the major cities throughout the United States. The whole problems associated with low income wages, problems associated with pensions, public pensions, the education crisis. These are monumental problems. And as long as the left, the working class, the poor, the national press, not organized to the extent that they can effectively take on these issues and actually create a crisis for the ruling interests in this country, it's going to continue. Even if we look, for example, at the issue of police brutality and police terror that's plaguing the entire United States, the only reason why it's become an issue now and why occasionally the president and other people in his administration have to address it is because of the growing demonstrations that have been taking place across the country, the rebellions that have erupted in Ferguson, in Baltimore, and just 2 weeks ago, or a week and a half ago in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Now, these are areas that have been extremely negatively impacted by the economic crisis, suburban St. Louis, also Baltimore, Maryland, where the city has been just devastated by home foreclosures, massive corruption that takes place within city government. There's a problem of police killings, which sparked a rebellion last year. And, of course, Milwaukee, which statistically, they claim the conditions there are worse for African Americans than they are in Detroit. This is what it has been published over the last week and a half as a result of the unrest in Milwaukee. So it's a challenge for all of these organizations on the left to get out and to do the work that's necessary. And it's not easy because you have communities that are being dislocated. You have people who are working one, two, three different jobs just trying to survive. And it's very difficult for people to organize living under those type of conditions.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, but we will continue this line of discussion in further discussions. But there is still the hope, and I like the idea that in the face of all these formidable challenges, there are people who are just not giving up. They are proceeding.
No.
They are working. They're working hard at holding on and asking others to participate also with that. So I want to thank you so much,
yeah,
Abayomi, for being with us today and for giving us
thank
so much to think about.
Okay, thank you.
All right. That brings us to the end of the program today. Tomorrow we go back to your basic questions of politics. I hope you'll join me then. Stay tuned. What's coming up next? It's the NDC Savings Club. You want to certainly pay attention to that. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Good stuff. Bye-bye.
Don't you ever let nobody drag your spirit down.